You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, DNR researchers have successfully tracked Wisconsin's smallest bat species for the first time. We'll talk to a bat expert about how they did it and what we've learned. First, if you watched last night's Golden Globes Awards ceremony, you likely saw actress and former talk show host Oprah Winfrey make an impassioned speech, one that some are even calling presidential. Here's a listen.
I've interviewed and portrayed people who've withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you, but the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning, even during our darkest nights. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon.
And after that speech, actually during that speech, rumors started floating around that Winfrey would take a shot at winning the Democratic nomination for president in 2020. Oprah isn't the first celebrity to have their name tossed out as a presidential possibility. We've heard everything from Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson to Kanye West with various levels of seriousness. Whether or not these particular celebrities actually run, it does seem like the Donald Trump story, moving from business to reality TV to a presidential win, has opened a new chapter in celebrity politics. Eric Casper joins us now. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and director of the university's Center for Constitutional Studies. Among other things, he researches politics and popular culture. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of speculation about Oprah Winfrey now. Let's start there. None of us can read her mind, of course, but what do you think about the concept of an Oprah Winfrey presidential campaign?
Well, if you go back and listen to that speech from last night, you find that there are a number of kind of big political issues that are discussed, issues related to race, sex and sexual harassment, class, freedom of the press, government power. And so in some respects, it did sound a bit like your typical kind of stump speech that you might hear a politician make. On the other hand, you know, there is a long history as well of celebrities at these types of award shows making political statements, and then they don't go on and run for office. They just want to call attention to a particular cause, and so that may very well have been what her plan was last night. She may not have expected that it would kind of turn into the public reaction that it has in the last 24 hours.
Is it normal for people to get excited about a celebrity maybe running for president? Or are we in new ground here?
Well, I think to a certain extent we're in new ground because of the success of President Trump being able to win the White House last year. But it shouldn't be forgotten that we also have a long history of celebrities, and including celebrity entertainers, running for office. Recall that, you know, President Ronald Reagan was an actor before he went into politics. Singer Sonny Bono was a singer before he was in politics. You have those from the world of sports, like Steve Largent and Tom Osborne, who were elected to Congress. And, of course, governors like Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jesse Ventura. So, it's not like this is a completely new thing in terms of these celebrities becoming politicians. But jumping from the world of celebrity or entertainment directly into a race for the White House, that is something where Donald Trump broke new ground when he ran in the 2016 election.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Somebody with no governmental experience going right from that, with no intermediate government steps, into the Oval Office seems new and different. And do you think that people, the voters, maybe would say, okay, well, if Donald Trump could do that, maybe this other celebrity I respect and admire could do that?
Yes and no. One way of thinking about this is, in a lot of respects, it opens the door, it breaks down the barrier that people may have perceived that was there from making that leap from being a celebrity into the White House, because if Donald Trump can do it, you know, that means other people could do it as well, and you might have celebrities who didn't think about it in the past who might be considering it because of that. On the other hand, I don't think that means that, you know, every celebrity out there has a significantly greater chance of being able to make that leap, simply because, you know, Donald Trump himself was, amongst celebrities even, a very well-known. And he had a long history of being in the public eye for decades before he ran for president. He has a particular type of personality that I think, you know, fits the notion that, I mean, you kind of need to have a lot of self-confidence, if you will, to be able to run for that office. And that might not be the case with some celebrities who don't have that experience in the political world. So, you know, I don't think this means that we're going to see a flurry of celebrities moving directly into races for the presidency. But it does open it up so that we're going to get more of this speculation, and it seems like a more realistic possibility for someone like Oprah to do something similar.
Talking to Eric Casper, political scientist at UW-Eau Claire. We're talking about celebrities and politics with rumors, speculation that Oprah Winfrey could run with Donald Trump, of course, in the White House. Eric, another strain of argument I've seen goes along these lines. In some ways, Donald Trump was the opposite of Barack Obama in their temperament and many other ways. So maybe what Democrats want and need is somebody boring, more of a technocrat, somebody, as somebody put it, you're not going to, whether you like him or not, somebody you're not going to think about more than once a week or so.
Well, I think that will, in many respects, depend on where things stand once we get to 2019 and early 2020, where are President Trump's approval numbers, assuming he's running for a second term. And that may, in many respects, drive which type of candidate like that would be more successful, someone who is a bit more brash, someone who makes those type of statements that we see from the president, or conversely, as you pointed out, someone who is a bit more relaxed in terms of their approach to public statements. You know, in some respects, it's kind of like when you look at football teams, and you know, if they're having trouble with the coach who is very forceful and is on the players, maybe you want to make a switch to someone who's a little more laid back. That may be kind of the approach that the American public wants if President Trump's approval ratings remain low. If his popularity increases, on the other hand, then that may not be the winning strategy.
Are we valuing personality more when we look at a high-profile political campaign than politics? And if so, is that a change?
No, well, yes and no, I think. I think that what you will find is that amongst voters, most voters have commitments to certain types of policy issues, and they're not going to be swayed necessarily by simply someone who is a celebrity. On the other hand, if that celebrity is speaking to the political issues that are important to a voter, they are going to be more likely to consider casting their ballot for them. And so I think it's a combination of those that, you know, that celebrity and that type of status can matter, but it's only going to matter if they're making enough connections to the voters in terms of what they want to see done with policy.
Given that a high-profile politician now is a media personality in and of themselves, are there skills that that celebrities from other walks of life might bring that are valuable to them as they run for office, as they hold office?
Yeah, well, you can think about it this way. Obviously, if they're a celebrity, it means that they already have name recognition, and that is an asset when running for a political office. They also are going to tend to have some level of personal wealth if they've been successful within the entertainment industry, for instance. And they're probably going to have wealthy friends, and that may help them in terms of campaign finance issues. And if they are particularly an entertainment celebrity, they tend to have some pretty good level of speaking ability, and they have experience with publicists and people like that in the industry too, so they know on a certain level how to get media attention. And so there are some skills there that can be very transferable to a political campaign.
Are we more forgiving of celebrity politicians when they're involved in scandal than, say, a more traditional politician?
Well, I think if you look at the point when they get elected to office and they're governing, you know, I think that's not an area that I think there's been a whole lot of study with in terms of does the public perceive them differently than a more traditional politician. But my guess is that for most people, and once you're at that point when if they do win and they are governing, the public is going to tend to judge them in the same way, because at that point they're not really that celebrity anymore as much as they are the elected official.
And finally, even if an Oprah or somebody like her doesn't end up running for president, obviously there's a lot of celebrity advocacy for causes and for politicians. Do they make a difference when they do that?
Well, part of this might go back to the old adage that if they keep doing it, it must mean that on a certain level there's some effect that they at least perceive to be there. And you have a history of this going back to the 19th century, and especially after the rise in the 20th century of radio and television, of these celebrities trying to influence politics, campaigning on behalf of traditional politicians, or calling attention to causes. I think that in a lot of respects, it's kind of like yard signs in a campaign. Do they have a lot of effect? I don't know about that, but if you didn't do them, like if you didn't have these celebrity endorsements, if you didn't have celebrities calling attention to these causes, we know that that wouldn't help. So it may help at the margin, and because of that, I think you're going to continue to see celebrities being involved in politics in those ways.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Eric Casper, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Eau Claire. He's director there of the Center for Constitutional Studies. He joined us to talk about the intersection of celebrity and presidential politics. First, researchers with the Department of Natural Resources have successfully tracked Wisconsin's smallest species of bat for the first time. Last spring, a hibernating eastern pipistrelle bat in Pierce County was fitted with a transmitter, tracked to its summer roost 35 miles away. It's given researchers new info on the bat's movements and habitat. Paul White is a mammal ecologist at the Wisconsin DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. He's with us in the studio. Paul, thanks a lot for coming up.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us first about this bat, the eastern pipistrelle.
Right. It's our smallest bat. So it's only about 3 inches long and roughly weighs about 3 pennies, so anywhere from 4 to 7 grams. So when you think about a transmitter, it has to be quite small to be able to track this individual.
And this has got to be a hard bat. I mean, I'm guessing if I were walking around, I wouldn't know they were around me necessarily. It's got to be hard to find and catch one to put a transmitter on.
Indeed, yes. They're very small, and they'll often roost in places where you just can't find them. They'll be maybe right over the top of you, or you'll walk by and you won't notice it. This is also a bat that doesn't commonly roost in artificial buildings or bat houses, so they're often roosting in live foliage like oak trees and oak leaves.
So what are you hoping to learn from this transmitter program? Why are you going to this effort to catch
this
little guy?
Well, it's all stemming. Most of the bat research now has stemming from white nose syndrome. Mm-hmm. And white nose syndrome is a fungal disease that was found in 2006 and was found to decimate hibernating bat populations, including the eastern pipistrelle. And it's a bat fungal disease that's causing them to arouse much more frequently. Typically, they're waking up anywhere from 15 to 20 days on average. This accelerates that process to where you see bats are waking up anywhere from 5 to 6 days on average, and they're expending that energy that they need to subsist throughout the winter. And so it's causing them to leave hibernation sites much earlier, and they're dying. And so really, this was an opportunity for us to be able to track an individual that just may not be here in the coming years. And so it's also an opportunity for us to learn more about the habitat, what it uses during this critical period when, white nose notwithstanding, you have a bat that spent 6 to 8 months of its life underground and leaves during that time. And it's a very critical time where they're very low on resources. So we're trying to minimize any possible disturbance around those areas, but then also protect the habitat that it ends up choosing in its summer landscape.
So talk about then how you and your team caught one of these bats and got a transmitter on it.
Right. So that was probably the hardest part, is redefining the timing or really honing in on the timing of when these bats are leaving these sites. So we know that in southern Wisconsin, we can see bats leaving these hibernation sites anywhere from the middle of April all the way through the end of April. This particular species likes to wait a little longer, so they're kind of the first one in and last one to leave. And so it took a couple of years for us to define when they actually leave. And so once we were able to figure out that they leave usually in the first week to a couple weeks after, right in May, we were able to set nets outside of a cave entrance and hope for the best. And we caught two right away and put transmitters on both of them and quickly followed them after that.
So I want to give a listen to what the bat tracker is hoping to hear on their receiver from this transmitter. This is what you need to keep up with. So you got the transmitter on. You've got people in their cars, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. they and now it's a movie chase scene, kind of. It sounds like, and it was touch and go.
Right, indeed. And so this bat, we have no idea where it's traveling. We've held it for just a little while to ensure that we've got everybody in position. We have somebody at the cave entrance, and they radio to everybody else saying, "Hey, we're about to release this individual." And so you've got folks in different cardinal directions hoping to catch that signal. And usually you're hearing just static, which is not really an exciting adventure. But then all of a sudden you hear this beep, and so you follow the beep, and you've got these you're basically leapfrogging, trying to get in front of this bat once you figure out the cardinal direction that it's going. And we've pretty much realized that once a bat decides to go on in one cardinal direction, it stays on it. And so it took us nearly an hour and a half, 2 hours to end up finding this individual after it left the hibernation site. And it was a biologist that found it near the Mississippi on almost a direct westerly direction, and then it flew almost 10 miles north of that, actually.
And I'm trying to visualize a little more. My receiver, it's not like in the Alien movies where I can see the direction the bat is relative to me. It's a beep. It's a signal strength.
Right.
If I move closer to it, the signal gets stronger. If I move further away, it gets weaker.
Correct.
That sounds hard to do.
It is, and especially with a moving target that's traveling at night. And so you obviously have to navigate, but then also as it's moving, it could be moving through forested areas, but also through bluffs and in valleys and where you're losing the signal. So you really have to be within a quarter mile to a half a mile away and constantly on that individual. And so, yeah, you need to have a lot of people that are really engaged and focused and lots of coffee.
We're talking to Paul White from the DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation, looking at a successful effort to track an eastern pipistrelle bat. Starting in Pierce County, Wisconsin, this is the smallest species of bat in the state, all part of an effort to track bat behavior and hopefully find solutions, ways to protect bats in the midst of a disease, white nose syndrome. So it worked. There was a gap there where you couldn't track down the bat, but eventually, right, you found where it went.
Right, and we found out where it went. It was just north of the city of Hudson and decided to roost in a white birch curl of a tree. And it stayed there for the next 5 days. So in cooperation with the Department of Natural Resources in Minnesota, we tracked that individual for about 5 days. And it was interesting that most of the time these bats are actually found in leaf foliage. And there's not much leaf foliage during that time in May, early May, depending on the weather. And so we assumed that this bat was seeking coverage in that particular location just because of there wasn't much leaf cover during that time.
And these bats end up mostly in trees throughout their awake part of the year?
Correct, yep.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know by following this one, what do we learn then about the range that bats go and what they're seeking when they come out of their cave?
Sure, well, again, it's one data point, but it's 100% more than we had prior to this. And so, you know, we're still learning about, we're trying to put sideboards on how far these individuals go. We know other bats about the same size will travel upwards of 350 miles from their hibernation site. So we were fortunate that it stayed within Wisconsin. It kind of puts sideboards on, hey, we believe that it now traveled 35 miles. We've looked at banding records prior to that, so you can put a small band on during the summer and then find it during the winter and then kind of connect the dots that way, except you don't really have a direction at that point. And so we know that through those banding records, we can the highest point or the highest distance was about 80 miles. And so 35 miles to about 80 miles is roughly, you know, what we've expected to find as far as they're leaving their hibernation sites, but they're staying relatively close compared to other bat species.
Do this kind of bat, maybe we don't know this, do they come back to the same hibernation spot that they started in?
Yes. In many cases, we have information to suggest that through banding records that these bats come back to the same exact spot. And even in the summer months as well, where they'll come back to those same spots. So it's very important to try and manage for both of those sites and protect those habitats as well.
Right. And then that's the next big question. You know where it hibernates. You know where it's going to live. I mean, not the exact tree, but the kinds of things. So what do we do with that? How do we protect the cave? How do we protect the other part
right.
of the season?
And so again, it comes to minimizing any type of incidental take, so bat mortality on its journey. And for example, you've got You know the direction in which it's going from the winter to the summer sites. And let's say that we've identified a major migratory path of bats, that they commonly use a particular waterway or a direction out of a major hibernation site. It would be advantageous to discourage maybe wind farm development within that area, because we know that that could be detrimental to bats during that time. And so it's just important to understand the direction, and then also where these individuals are coming from and going as well.
Will this start to give us any insight into how white nose syndrome, if it's an infectious disease, which I thought it was, right, how it gets spread from one bat group to another?
Absolutely. This would definitely build into models where you would be able to say, we know that this particular species travels at this range, and then you can definitely build that into model. Unfortunately, white nose syndrome has been in Wisconsin for 4 years, and this is actually its fifth year, so those models are somewhat outdated, but it can help build, because the eastern pipistrelle does occur in over 38 states and all the way down to Mexico as well.
Can you talk about what's at stake here for the eastern pipistrelle and other bats of Wisconsin and how we rely on them too?
Right. So if you look at the eastern pipistrelle and the mortality that we've observed since the inception of white nose syndrome in 2014 that we found, but the second year we find that there's a 40% reduction in the bat population of eastern pipistrelles. That third year of infection, we see a nearly 70% reduction.
Wow.
And in a fourth year, we're seeing upwards of 95% reduction. So nearly all of the eastern pipistrelles are gone once you have 4 and 5 year infections. So these are big stakes, and to get information on individuals like this could help protect other species, but as well as species in other states as well. And so they're a valuable asset to not only industry, but to humans as well. They consume a variety of insects, can consume anywhere from 1,000 mosquito-sized insects in 1 hour, and especially if they're pregnant or nursing during that time. And so they've projected that anywhere from $658 million all the way to $1.5 billion is the value of the added costs of bats consuming insects that we would otherwise have to spray pesticides and such.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
That's Paul White, mammal ecologist with the DNR's Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation. He talked with us about the first successful tracking of Wisconsin's smallest bat species. First, YouTube star Logan Paul has been facing an angry backlash, lots of criticism, after a video showing a suspected suicide victim in a Japanese forest. He pulled the video offline following the outcry and issued 2 apologies, but despite the controversy, Paul remains as popular as ever. Paul's audience tends to skew young, as do many YouTubers, with viewers under 16 making up the bulk of his 15 million subscriber base on YouTube. His reach has many people wondering about the pull that many of these internet stars have, and whether companies like YouTube and Facebook should do more to prevent content like this reaching more people. And stories like this raise wider concerns about unmediated media and who, if anyone, is in charge and at fault when lines are crossed. Kathleen Culver is in the studio with us. She's an assistant professor and director of UW-Madison's Center for Journalism Ethics. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we dig into this controversy we were talking just before the show, a reaction for a lot of people, this is who did what now? There's this, for people over a certain age, a very low age, there's an invisible network of celebrities out there.
And it's a vast network. I think a lot of people who are used to watching the CBS Evening News or the latest sitcom on NBC, they don't understand that for kids, actually now in their 20s and 30s, this is broadcast to them, that there are internet stars that would be completely unrecognizable to me if I didn't have a 15-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm. And people in some cases making millions of dollars doing this, branding themselves, they have sponsors. It's a big and growing business.
It's incredibly lucrative for the top level of stars, and even people who don't have the kind of following that Paul has can make a decent living doing this sort of thing with video blogging about their weight loss journey, for instance. You can have a small but very dedicated following and make some coin off of it.
And in this particular case, Logan Paul, this well-known YouTuber, millions of followers, he was in this kind of famous, it's called a suicide forest in Japan, I guess, where people go to kill themselves, to die. And he went there with a camera, and then broadcast what appeared to be someone who had hung themselves. Mm. And so what was your reaction to that controversy and the backlash to that?
So my reaction right out of the gates, I heard about it fairly early, was absolute disgust. I think that when we're talking about a public health issue like suicide that is so misunderstood in this culture, but one that so deeply affects specifically the age range that he markets to, you know, suicide is the second leading cause of death for college-age students. So we need to be really careful socially in thinking about this. And so I was disgusted. I was quite surprised that YouTube did not take it down faster and that it was actually left to him to bring it down. I think that raises some serious questions.
We'll get into those. I want to give a listen to Logan Paul's apology. He did a couple of videos after the reaction to his initial video and him taking that down. Here's part of what he said.
I want to apologize to the internet. I want to apologize to anyone who's seen the video. I want to apologize to anyone who has been affected or touched by mental illness or depression or suicide. But most importantly, I want to apologize to the victim and his family.
Talk about the apology.
I mean, I think it was a sincere apology. I did sense that he understood that he had gone wrong. I still struggle to believe that he didn't get that before he posted the video, that it would take this backlash to bring that realization. But it just goes to show you how much further we have to go in educating people about this issue.
It's easy to do this, to do stuff online, not necessarily to be a big high profile star like this, but it's not hard to take a video and post it on YouTube. Do you think that that makes a very short-circuited editorial process? You don't really think about the implications of what you just capture on your camera or your phone, for that matter. Post, boom, it's done.
Look, if 60 Minutes went and was trying to report on this forest in Japan that the Japanese government does not like to have publicized, this would have been the subject of countless internal ethics discussions, a standards editor looking at it, potentially some lawyers looking at it. But here we have one person, and he has producers who work with him, but really it's a very, very short-circuited ethical conversation. And that's what these digital technologies have brought us, a dramatic and speedy expansion of the freedom to publish without, alongside it, a really in-depth discussion about the responsibilities that come with that freedom.
Talking to Katie Culver from the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics about the ethics of YouTubers and other people posting online after a controversy where one widely followed YouTube star posted a video apparently of a suicide victim in Japan and an angry backlash to that. You mentioned YouTube and what their responsibility might be, and there are other people who host different formats of online things, of course. What responsibility does a company, let's focus on YouTube, have?
Well, I think they have tremendous responsibility, though it's always been very difficult. They have very zealously protected this idea of whether it's Facebook or YouTube or Google, of themselves as platforms, not as content producers. And they actually have enshrined in law some protections that they are the tube through which these things go. They don't have responsibility for them. I think the interesting thing to me, the character of this backlash, was that there was certainly backlash against Logan Paul. But to me, especially in sort of the tech journalism sector, it was very, very much focused on YouTube and how this could have stayed up there for 24 hours. And when it became clear that human moderators within Google had seen it when the takedown requests were coming in and allowed it to stay up without even a strike against him, that was stunning to me.
It seems like we're struggling for metaphors with internet media and journalism. If we think of YouTube or Google as the newspaper, then we would think they would have some sort of editorial responsibility. If we think of them as the paper company that sells to the newspaper, we would, of course, not think they have any responsibility. Are we having trouble defining our terms here?
Well, I think we're trying too hard to take what we understood of the analog age and apply it to the digital age. And, you know, there are good reasons that legal protections apply to these kinds of carriers, to Google or to a Facebook. But that does not mean that they don't have ethical obligations. So law tells us what we can do, and that's fine, that's settled. But ethics tell us what we should do. And here, I think, you know, you see it certainly with Facebook and hoax and Russian meddling through advertising in the election, a real reckoning, a kind of sort of internal look at, and external look at what our responsibilities are as platforms, because they have tremendous, tremendous power.
Do you see these platforms trying to take on this responsibility? I mean, whether we're talking about shocking videos on YouTube or Nazis and misogynists on Twitter or lots of stuff on a place like Reddit, and you mentioned the Facebook example, are they... Do you see a growth of ethical responsibility in, on these platforms?
I do see some growth. I think it's slow moving. You know, I was really struck just after the election when there were some congressional hearings about what had happened. There were some executives from the Big Five who went up there, but they weren't sort of the CEO or the COO. And it really struck me when I compared it to after the Bush versus Gore election and news media calling the election too early for Gore, and there were similarly congressional hearings, but we're talking about the highest ranking executives from NBC, ABC, and CBS up there really having that day of reckoning, and you didn't see that right out of the box. Now, Facebook has really changed course. They've been much more public about their responsibilities and what they're going to do to try to change this. And by the way, these are not easy questions. It's not as if YouTube has a simple solution here. We're talking about a platform where people upload, just get this, 600,000 hours of content, new content, a day. There is no algorithm that can handle that moderation. There is no set of humans that can handle that moderation. So this is not a small problem. It's not as if YouTube is doing nothing, but they haven't, the one thing that they haven't done that I think people call for, they haven't been very transparent about what they are doing. And that makes it difficult for others to suggest potential alternatives.
Yeah, can you talk more about the idea of transparency as a part of the puzzle here?
Yeah, so YouTube has a few ways to deal with content that is problematic. One is, you know, having some sort of artificial intelligence to try to suss out what's wrong. The second is human moderation, so people who go through and view and try to sense this. And this is a case where I don't think AI had much of a chance of sensing that this was a problem. You really need a human to see this and understand it. And then they also have money, so they can divert advertising away from problematic users. They can take users off, which they do with their three strikes program. So they use all of those, but they don't tell us much. They're incredibly opaque about how they do that. You know, there was no way to tell if a human had seen and okayed the Logan Paul video. They were completely black about it.
A common theme in the early days of comment boards and online forums was the community is going to police itself. So we'll have a system where you can report or maybe block bad content, however we're going to define that. How did that work out?
Well, it certainly did not work well in this case, although the public backlash did work. Here's the thing about algorithms. They are built to deliver to you content that you will value. So that, when I go and search on YouTube, that Logan Paul video is not going to come up in my feed. I'm the kind of person who would be offended by it, who would raise a red flag, who would be part of that community policing. But when algorithms take content and direct it at the kind of people who are going to value it, like people who have liked other violent content or other content related to suicide, there's not a chance that I can see it and be part of that policing community.
That raises a disturbing question. If someone out there has searched for advice on suicide prevention, could an algorithm poorly done forward them something like this, a shocking suicide-related, not prevention-related material?
Well, in part because Logan Paul said that that's what this was about, that it was about trying to wake people up to the problem of suicide, which was, I think, a bit of an edit after the fact. You know, if this had really been serious, he wouldn't have gone out there in his, you know, flaming green cartoon character hat. It was all problematic across the board. But yes, algorithms can deliver content. You know, if someone is going on and searching for tools to combat alcoholism, they can, if the algorithm is poorly written, get more alcohol-based content, and that can be a real problem.
We're talking to Katie Culver right now, assistant professor and director of UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics. She's with us to talk about the controversy surrounding a YouTube star who posted a video showing an alleged suicide victim in a Japanese forest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you followed this particular controversy yourself? What do you think? What do you think this says about the internet? And on a wider note, what do you think about all the opportunities out there for people to publish, to post online, largely without gatekeepers, without editors? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Katie Culver is with us. She's the Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're continuing our conversation about ethics on the internet following the outcry over a video by a YouTube star named Logan Paul showing a suspected suicide victim in a Japanese forest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this particular controversy, and how about the wider issues of what social media platforms, think YouTubes, Twitters, Facebook, you name it, what kind of responsibility do they have for the content that gets posted on their sites? Should they do more to police it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to your calls now. John is on the line in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. Yes, I think that's a good thing that they showed the video. I think the kids nowadays need to see more graphic stuff that would deter them. Had someone shown me a video like that when I was a kid, I may have not attempted slitting my wrist had someone showed me a non-Hollywood version. It's like, I think if kids nowadays were to witness someone ODing on heroin, I think they would realize that how bad it really is if they actually saw it firsthand.
John, thanks for sharing the call and your experience. He says maybe seeing a gritty, awful thing would have a deterrent effect.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have a very clear picture of that, not just in the case of suicide, but the use of graphic warnings on, say, cigarette advertising, for instance. You know, is that actually effective? And we don't have a solid answer. In the case of suicide, and I don't want to pretend to be a public health expert on that issue. I mean, I have done some work on the ethics of covering suicide. We do have real concern about a contagion effect, about moving people toward an action that they would not otherwise take when they see certain kinds of coverage.
And that's something where, again, if a media outlet were doing it, hopefully they would talk to someone who was an expert on it to talk about, are there things in our coverage of, say, suicide that might trigger copycat behavior rather than, we'll do it?
Right. We do know from research that talking about the specifics of an act can increase that effect. Playing up the drama of, you know, someone who is going to be mourned and missed, we're better off when we talk about depression and anxiety as issues, because well over 90% of suicides are related to that long-term ingrained depression and anxiety. It is also important for any reporters or editors or producers out there. We do also know very clearly that stories about this issue should include references to a local hotline or other help that you can receive. It's a very simple thing that you can include in your coverage that makes a difference, the kind of difference that this caller talks about, that's something that may have helped him not attempt to take his own life.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Jacob with us in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi. Jacob, are you there? I think we have a really bad connection with Jacob. Our producer summed it up. Jacob said the video he thinks is in poor taste, but he doesn't think we can prevent people from posting things like this. As you're saying, so much gets posted. If we're going to have the platform the way we want it, can we have any kind of control over it?
And the question is whether we want the platform to be operating in this way. You know, we have had decades of a very serious dedication to free expression and lack of any kind of censorship on digital platforms. And, you know, we as users get to decide, is that the way that we want this to continue? Do we want to do this? And you saw in this case, and you've seen in plenty of others, people say, no, I don't want it to operate in that way. And this is offensive and problematic. And if it contributes to others considering these kinds of acts, we want it taken down. So do I think that we can completely cleanse a platform to be something that we want some perfect ideal? No, because I don't think we all agree on what that ideal would be. But you should have a situation in which people can say, I reject this kind of content. I see it as harmful. I see it as irresponsible, and get it out of my platform.
We heard from John on Facebook. John writes, do something for views, apologize if there's a backlash, and repeat, YouTube won't crack down on the large personas because these people bring millions of views to the platform daily. So YouTube in part depends on the success of their celebrities.
And John is absolutely right in that my big concern here is that we're seeing we need to continue to push the envelope. So to what extent was this Logan Paul case a message to other YouTube celebrities that, whoa, wow, you really got to get out there now. You got to be, you got, we've now set a boundary. You're going to get more views if you go beyond that boundary. It's just the classic case of sensationalism, competition driving us to do more and more sensational things. I don't have the answer to that. I don't have the way to solve that other than to say, every time that we respond, we are telling that platform and that producer that we reject this. Now, to me, you know, if I were one of his 6 million people who had viewed that, or if I was one of his subscribers, I would no longer be one of those subscribers.
But presumably the people who are subscribers to him already are walking down that path with him in a way.
It could be. I mean, I think you did see some people who were actually his fans reacting badly to this and being shocked by it. And, you know, it's a message to parents. You know, I'm one. The first question to my son, who's a freshman in college, was, do you follow this guy? And if so, be done. That's enough.
I want to give the National Suicide Prevention Hotline, since we've raised issues of suicide, thanks to our producer for getting that for us, 800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-8255. Time for another caller, Brianne in Madison. Brianne, hi.
Hi. As a fellow YouTuber, I have to follow a lot along the lines of the community guidelines that YouTube members, YouTube creators have to follow. Unfortunately, the content that that he posted actually violates those rules of content, and it was brought to the attention of a YouTube staffer who reviewed the video and did not flag it, did not take it down. It was the Paul brother that did end up taking it down. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, with the relationship that the Paul brothers have with YouTube as kind of their golden children that bring in a lot of users, that bring in a lot of traffic to the site, they really have been given an unfair advantage in terms of the kind of content that they put on their channel. And it really puts it at a disadvantage of other users.
Brianne, thanks for the call. So the community guidelines are don't apply to everyone equally, she says.
Yeah, I think Brianne is expressing something that a number of journalists would say if they were here, which is, hey, it's all well and good that I'm following these ethics guidelines and I'm worrying about minimizing harm and being independent and trying to not be biased. But then off goes Brian Ross on ABC News, who runs something that's just patently false without checking his sources thoroughly. And now he has played into this fake news narrative. So I can be as ethical and responsible as possible, but others in the community, others in my profession, can damage the public's trust in that profession. And I think she's right. When the profit motive is strong, responsibility can suffer.
We'll leave it there for now. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. A really important topic.
Kathleen Culver is the Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison and Director of UW-Madison's Center for Journalism Ethics. She joined us to talk about the controversy surrounding a YouTube star, Logan Paul, following his video post showing a suicide victim in a Japanese forest and some of the wider issues of internet fame and internet broadcasting.